reasons why we like historic development is the way that the buildings frame spaces. They were putting buildings in little clusters because they wanted to create an outdoor room so they could, say, sell sheep in it in the 16th to the 17th century. The most famous example of an outside room is St. Mark's Square in Venice, which has the most fabulous scale, and everybody refers to it as a drawing room. It's the best outside room in the world.
Good architecture isn't just about buildings. It's also about how they're laid out and the spaces around them. Classically, architects design places. But Renaissance Venice wasn't exactly a democracy. And in recent decades, amid our messily democratic politics of architecture, the ideal of making places has clearly proved all too hard to live up to.
The featureless concrete creepers, which have sprawled out more recently and so grotesquely into the surrounding countryside.
I think it would be a great sort of disruptive thing for one to merge into the other.
Unwanted, unsightly, homogenised suburbia, spreading out further and further.
And really, you just get sprawl without any kind of identity.
By the late 1980s, state architecture was discredited and disempowered. The making of much-needed new development fell to the commercial volume builders, and their irresistible force clashed with the seemingly immovable obstacles of the planning system. The focus fell so heavily on where new developments were built that we lost sight of how to make desirable places.
House builders know how to build houses. They don't yet know how to make towns and communities. If you're selling sprawl, the first house is worth the most, because you're selling the idea that you live in the countryside. If you're selling a town, the last house is worth the most because you've built a place that people want to be in.
But under-designed or half-baked anywhere housing estates have sprawled further out into the landscape. And so now the idea that we need to rediscover the art of designing places is pushing its way up the political agenda. Britain does have a housing crisis, and if we're going to build hundreds of thousands more homes, we might want to learn from our recent failures. Architecture Minister Ed Vasey and one of our leading architects, Terry Farrell, think the problem with British architecture today lies not so much with style, more with this question of placemaking.
For me, it's more to do with not necessarily the individual building, but the feel of a community. When these housing developments are put together. So I'm interested in whether the development itself feels on a human scale and feels navigable. And sometimes you get developments that are impossible to orientate yourself around.
I get more worked up not by buildings but by spaces. If you go out in any street, any high street, any road that's going through an urban area, it's a complete mess. And I don't mean visually in terms of visual control, which development control tries to control, like signage. I just mean the poles and the railings and the patterns on the tarmac. Everyone has a go.
It's striking that Farrell recently won a major commission to design a redevelopment of Earl's Court in West London using exactly this logic.
I started off with place and with spaces between buildings. And I don't think architects were doing that 50 years ago. They'd start off with the house and the housing and the block of flats. I think it's now about mixture and the balance. It's about community. It's about neighbourhood. So I call my winning entry Four Villages and a High Street, because I wanted to continue what has worked, that in London, the urban villages and the high streets and the good streets and the squares and the parks are what people remember. And in fact, a street outlives all the buildings along it.
But more generally, developers have to build houses people will buy, anywhere from the city to the countryside to the suburbs in between. And I wonder if one reason for those anywhere housing estates on the edge of so many towns and cities is in fact one of the great democratic loves of the English people, the suburban garden.
Just as the houses are furnished with stair carpets, lampshades, umbrella stands and chests of drawers, so, inside and out being one, the suburban scene is itself furnished with an almost limitless variety of properties in the shape of trees and shrubs, trellis work and rockeries. and these are disposed and displayed with instinctive, though unconscious, skill.
J.M. Richards' 1946 Anatomy of Suburbia, The Castles on the Ground, shows how it's our garden that helps us shape a special private world, even if our house looks the same as the one next door. So I asked the planning minister, Nick Bowles, do people have a moral right to a garden?
I think that people have a moral right to expect to be able to bring up their children in at least as healthy circumstances as they themselves were brought up. I think it's an absolute fundamental progressive position, which is that, you know, each generation should be trying to pass on the world and life to the next generation in at least as good a form and ideally a better form. And I think that most of us felt that having a childhood in which we had easy access towards green space was critical. Now, not all of us did, but many of us did. And I would be very, very uncomfortable with the suggestion that we should be imposing on the next generation, through our failure to grapple with some of these problems, a childhood where they had no access to green space and that they were living on the eighth floor of a building, you know, with a park half a mile away. If people choose that, that's completely fine. But if they want to have a small house with a scrappy garden, then I think my job as a politician is to make sure that we deliver on that.
But is a land of sprawling cul-de-sacs inevitable if nearly everyone does indeed want at least a small house with a scrap of garden? Cul-de-sacs do provide this. Well, at least one developer, Barclay, says it has an alternative way of meeting the English desire for domestic greenery. I went to see one of their new developments on the borders of southeast London.
We're just walking past, as you can hear, the last of the demolition going on this week. So the last of the Ferrier estate will disappear this week. And you can see just up ahead the second phase of the development.
This new development, Kidbrook Village, is replacing a notorious concrete estate from the 70s, the Ferrier, with a mix of flats and houses, some private, some social. Matt Bell from Barclay showed me around.
It's a long street going down for, there must be, 50 or 60 homes there. They all have a relatively small private garden behind them, but what we have also is then Sutcliffe Park, so just over there, a huge great public park. One of the interesting things in a new development is how you get a sense of community quite quickly. Now, we all have a very traditional attachment to our private garden. Actually, what that does tend to do is isolate you a fraction, whereas the public assets, like the park, the shops, the play space just over there, the youth club, that's where we, as Barclay, we tend to put our money to create the assets which really make a place hum as a place to live.
So Barclay's aim is to lay out its suburban village in a way that reconciles that desire for private gardens and green spaces with a real sense of place rather than a labyrinth of cul-de-sacs. But can they really do that and make money?
Barclay, as a developer, our business model is a little different. So there's a lot of other house builders who essentially have a volume model. So you make your money by doing the numbers, as many as possible, and the margins. Barclay is all about added value. So the build quality, the design quality, those are all things that we'd invested hugely. So we've spent about £9 million on the soft landscaping at Kidbrook. But what it does is create a sense of place. In the private homes, people will obviously pay much more for it. And I think we have a social obligation to do great social housing.
The landscaping here has made a big effort, I can see, to include children who are running around over there in the playground.
So one of the key things that makes the place work is actually the quality of the urban design, not just the architecture. So it's the spaces between the buildings as much as the buildings themselves, and it's the way the different amenities and facilities like a school, like a playground, are knitted together so you can get from one to the other nice and easily. How the streets are laid out, how the buildings here connect to the school just over there, which you can hear, whether the streets themselves feel safe. It's those things which knit a place together.
Barclay's business, though, is very much focused in southern England and mostly in cities. I wonder whether the Kidbrook blend of streets of houses with small gardens, landscape parkland and substantial blocks of flats would work in parts of Britain where people might expect less suburban landscaping and want more private garden. This demand could still leave us with countless thousands of new anywhere cul-de-sacs. David Birkbeck, Chief Executive of Design for Homes, argues that a broader solution is being found by tackling the cul-de-sac's obscure origins in local planning.
During the 60s, 70s, 80s, and in fact most of the 90s, there was really seriously just one way that volume house building was done, And it was done according to what the local highways department thought was the right way to do things. They were stretching out into countryside. And so the highways officer would say, well, what we want is a big distributor road that takes people out to this new development, and then you will lay out your housing around the individual roads that will branch off that. Now, if you think in terms of that distributor road, it's like the trunk of a tree, and then the branches that come off it are the individual roads where people live in their new homes. Each one of those branches that came off would end in a thing that looks like a snake's tongue. So people picking up your bins would be able to go into one side of the snake's tongue and then reverse back into the other and then turn around and drive away. And that's always the end of a cul-de-sac. So every single one of those streets was designed to function for refuse vehicles and not as a place.
And this, Birkbeck argues, was ideal for volume builders focused on the commercial efficiencies of standardisation, not placemaking.
They would just put a pair of semis or a detached, another pair of semis to track the road layout, not to create spaces between them, not to create little clusters of buildings that people would sort of feel had got some kind of sort of almost like tableau-like qualities. They were just doing what they were told by the highways officers and exploiting the fact that would allow them to produce non-specific designs that they could put on any road layout. It was none of the character of a traditional development where we would normally relate quite emotionally to the proximity of buildings and the way they frame spaces.
I would differentiate a street from a road.
Hank Dittmar, author of Transport and Neighbourhoods, is a leading exponent of what he calls street-based urbanism, which seeks to shift the priority back from cars to people.
A road is designed for the throughput of vehicles, and a street is really designed as a bit of public space, a public realm, and it's absolutely vital, I think.
But it's a street that's been disappearing in new developments. I mean, new housing developments, most new edge-of-town developments, whether they're housing or business parks or distribution depots or all these new building types across the country, are built just as a continuous sprawl. There's no streets there.
Essentially, they've changed the name of them from places' names, like a lane is different from a mews, is different from an avenue, is different from a boulevard. They all conjure up types of places to us, to things like arterials, collectors, and motorways. I come from the United States originally, and there the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices defines a pedestrian as a traffic flow interruption.
But then, says David Birkbeck, politicians intervened and things began to change.
In the 90s, the Conservative government turned against house building and attacked design quality. And John Gummer referred to the experience. He said that the housing that was being built is the stuff that people just walk by. There is no reason for them to enter that scheme because there's nothing in there for them. And he said it's got to do better. It's got to be a place which is built that people walk through. And by 1999, there was this sense that design was really important and we were getting these standardized layouts everywhere. And the government of the day produced a draft policy that essentially said we want everything to change, and that was adopted formally in March 2000. For the first time in 30 years, it gave the planning authority officers the power to reject poor design. Now, that turned things on its head very, very quickly. People began to ask, well, what is good design?
One answer, backed up by some local political power, came from a surprising courter, the Prince of Wales. Hank Dittmar is his special advisor on global urbanisation and was closely involved in the project that broke the highway engineer's stranglehold, Poundbury, an extension of Dorchester, the county town of Dorset.
We were fortunate there to have a local authority who were interested in engaging with traffic engineers like Alan Baxter to rethink the role of the street and to really rethink how we deal with the car in the urban environment. And we don't have any traffic signs. We don't have bollards. We don't have railings at the edge of the street. We use the architecture to frame the street. So you might come to the end of a place where you want the car to behave differently, and you might have a colonnade coming right out to the edge of the pavement. And that sends a signal to the driver to pay attention.
Yet some people think Poundbury, which is not just about traditional street plans, but also traditional buildings, is all a bit too chocolate boxy. David Birkbeck again.
That became a default option, and actually I think there were a lot of very poor examples of it with copies all over the country. It sort of spread like some kind of a rash. But what it did, and you know, this is the fundamental benefit of Poundbury that has changed the way we think about things, because of royal patronage saying, I don't want your standardized road layout, it broke the mold, and people began to understand that they could start creating places where the buildings were more dominant than the highways. And over the last 10 years, we've learnt increasingly to roll back the standardised set of things like 6-inch deep concrete curbs, black top everywhere you looked.
And we're about to come onto not a normal highways-driven road, but actually a smaller, tighter block-paved road where you've got traffic shared with frontages of dwellings and pedestrians. You get some of that eeliness coming back in.
In our last programme, I visited an estate on the edge of Ely in Cambridgeshire with no sense of place, but I went to meet local planning officers Giles Hughes and Nigel McCurdy to walk through another Ely development. There, in the rain, they showed me how they'd encouraged the developers to lay the houses out and use details in a very different way, to create a place that felt, as they put it, Ely-esque.
And just above you now, on your left, is the first gable elevation of a property. Mm. And you'll see there's windows in it. Rather than looking at blank gables as you walk along developments, actually making it look more Ely-esque.
And you've let nature start to take over.
And I think that's where, you know, retaining some of the hedges that we saw just on that footpath there is so important. Some of those characteristics on the edge of fields, retain them, actually keep that sense of it being partly historic and not just completely new.
That Ely development was won at the price of local planners drawing up an Ely design code and insisting developers follow it. But not every local authority was willing to follow the same Fenland path. As David Birkbeck says, some simply aped Poundbury and its very different Dorset landscape. So in 2001, and again last year, he sketched out a set of principles, building for life, to demonstrate that the age-old rules of laying out a place could be married to any architectural style, and not just to copies of quaint new Poundbury cottages.
Building for Life deliberately set out to prove that there are particular rules for creating places. So you could have very modern houses or very old-fashioned houses, but as long as they had the urban design right, the landscaping right, the public realm strategy correct, that they could create the same qualities that people would respond to. Now, we went out and we found particularly Catholic mixes of housing, so estates regeneration schemes in places like North Shields, little housing developments and hamlets in places like Leicestershire, and we showed that what made these schemes of an equal quality for the people that lived in them was the way that people could relate to the buildings around them and the streets in which they lived. Would that street function as anything other than a carriageway for a vehicle? Could you have a street party in it? Could you expect to meet your neighbour in it? Was there a pavement for you to walk down and talk to your neighbour? Was there a likely place for you to be able to sit? And Building for Life championed things like the type of furniture that we all take for granted in cities where you get bench seats, but which won Greenfield extensions at the time was totally absent. There was never any kind of amenity beyond the plot of the house. And by having a series of design ideas for ways that could be countered, we began to get across the idea to planning authorities and to developers that the whole varying range of models you could use, but the basic characteristics would be that the houses should create spaces between them for people to live in communities as opposed to roads for vehicles to pass down.
Building for Life is enthusiastically endorsed by government, by Nick Bowles, the planning minister. But is it enough? Could there be some direct government mechanism to raise and maintain standards?
You wouldn't want to have a politician imposing their view of what's beautiful on the country. I know what I like, but it isn't what everybody likes, and I don't believe that we should only build what I like. But on the other hand, you do want to nudge the industry and the profession in the direction of a process which tends to arrive at a better result. And the one that I'm most sort of keen on is Building for Life standards. That now the industry seems to be gradually adopting more and more. Partly, I think, because, you know, perhaps because people like me have been talking it up, but also partly because I think they've realised that they might actually be able to sell the product at a slightly higher price. And again, as a conservative and a believer in the market system, I'm all in favour of people thinking that quality makes them all money.
But nevertheless, the pitch you'd still get at the end of that in 5 years, 10 years' time would be patchy. There's local authorities with very little money.
Very few staff, very few qualified staff in their local authorities who know what they're doing. Is there any way that government perhaps is responsible for creating a balance, a harmony across the country?
I wouldn't want to accept that you're only going to get good design if you've got local authorities pursuing a particular approach or employing a particular kind of people. I think that good design can happen and does happen without it being much the result of the local authorities' intervention. On the other hand, there clearly is a role for local authorities that want to get involved to encourage good design.
The biggest volume house builder to embrace building for life is Barratt Homes. Barratt Homes, a developer whose name for many people has long conjured up those anywhere houses arranged around cul-de-sacs.
I think the big focus for us is the space between the houses is as important as getting the design of the houses right. And I think that's a big learning over the last few years. And things like Building for Life, as you know, that's where the focus is.
The company's chief executive, Mark Clare, invited me to walk with him around one of his latest developments in the East End of London. It shows, he says, just how far Barratt, with the help of Building for Life, has been changing its approach.
You know, it is actually common sense. That's what I like about Building for Life, which is why we've adopted it as an organisation and we use it everywhere with our new developments.
Is it public spaces in here or is it private? It's not a gated community.
No, you've got a mixture of spaces. Because it is such a large site, you have to make it available for access for people coming from the train station or bus stations. But also we've been able to provide private space as well. So some of the courtyards are very much for the residents. Obviously, we also give the residents balconies and on the lower floors, gardens. So it's a good mixture. But again, it's another one of those challenges with a site that's quite dense and you know, with an awful lot of built-up area. We've been able to incorporate the two. But as you can see, they're very different. It's very clear what's a public thoroughfare and what's private for the residents. I mean, one of the key things is the materials you use will then define what the space is for. So it's very, very clear there's a lot of hard finishes here. Well, there's a lot of hard finishes because people and cars can travel through this space. So, you know, the green space is much more limited. Whereas if you go back to the private areas, you know, it's much more green. You've got lots of landscaping in there. There's paths, there's seats for people. So, I mean, actually, the use of the materials can define very, very much what these spaces are about. And if spending a little bit of money with architects delivers a different result, then you get immediate payback from a business point of view.
A lot of commercial house building over the last century, really, has been added on to towns. And so you have the sort of famous cul-de-sac developments all over Britain. And I know you're smiling when I say that, because cul-de-sacs, yeah, they're controversial things. Some people love them, some people hate them. But the idea of the sprawl has been associated with house builders.
I mean, the challenge is, how do you create great places to live when actually you've built 1,000 homes that would otherwise all look the same? Well, you don't make them all look the same. You actually break it up into parts and you use different types of homes, different finishes. You use different open spaces. Sometimes you may have more dense areas. Sometimes there may be more open areas. You use the open space, and there's a lot more open space on new developments than we would have ever had before. And you use that to create the nice places to live. I think it can be done. There are still examples of very, very large sites that are still trundling on, so I'm not saying that those don't exist. But actually, as a company, what we like is smaller sites, or if they're larger sites, we actually break them into different elements.
Well, we're walking through a courtyard now at the centre of the development. These are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what are these, 6-storey, are they 7, 8-storey apartment blocks, yeah, clad in brick with balconies, their gardens in the centre.
We've got townhouses at the bottom. So we actually have houses here. So an unusual element. So we actually have houses on the bottom of the blocks. Yeah. That was a requirement of the local authority and the local planners. What they wanted was larger family homes also incorporated into what would otherwise be just an apartment scheme.
It seems to me, as I go around the country, the sort of third, fourth rate new housing is particularly in areas where the local authorities are strapped for cash. And the evidence in my eyes tells me that a house builder's sort of got one over the local authority, in a sense. They can just say, well, if you don't want it, we can walk away, and this is what we're going to give you. And the local authority says, yes, okay, we need the houses, we'll accept these, and the standards seem low.
I think over the last 4 or 5 years, everything has changed, because as we've gone through the recession, we have had to focus on absolutely making sure we build houses that people want to buy. Because, to be honest, it was a
for a lot of our industry, it was about survival. So a massive focus on getting it right. As an organisation, we have choices where we invest. And one of the key things that we will decide today is, can we actually build the sort of homes that we know local people will want to buy? Because we sell almost all our homes to local people. So if we run up against local authorities who say, we want you to build something that we don't think works, we will simply say, well, we're going to invest somewhere else. So it's not about saying, well, can we get away with the, you know, the cheapest solution? That is not what we do today, because it just doesn't work. We have to appeal to customers. There's a lot of competition out there. Our biggest competitor is secondhand. You know, obviously, new build is quite small. So we have to actually raise the bar, and we have been raising the bar over the last 5 years to ensure that everything we deliver is attractive to those who are going to buy.
The bricks pattern here is the opposite of the one I've just seen. It's lovely, so you get this sudden contrast in colour and pattern and texture. The courtyards are planted, they're landscaped, and they have ferns and thistles and lavender, and they're set about with pebbles and rocks and benches and trees. It's alive, and there's small private gardens too. There's already people sitting here using them, so it's a place that has a sense of, there's a relaxed feel here, and given we're right in past the big old busy East End with the railway line next to us, very busy roads, it's surprisingly calm. But some are sceptical that prescriptions like Building for Life can really drive a general change through the building industry. Alex Morton from Policy Exchange argues that design guides can't make much difference. He thinks the key is to empower local people.
For the last 20 years, we've had an approach where we thought if we had more regulations and sort of guidance on quality and design, that would drive it up. So starting with PPG1 in the 90s, which had 62 references to design and told local planners they had to obsess about it. Basically, continuing to the present day, there's been an endless stream of edicts and regulations saying design is really important. That approach, I think, has totally and utterly failed. And our argument is that actually the best ways to get architects and developers to have to propose to local people development that is of sufficient quality. And I think it wouldn't be a click your fingers overnight process, but I think you would reasonably rapidly get a much higher quality of development that was in tune with what local people wanted, with the feel of the area. And that is the way that we get back to quality design. You decide what you think is acceptable in your area or not, and developers then have to respond to that. And if developers come up with shoddy schemes, they don't get the planning permission, they can't build anything, and they can't make a profit.
In our next programme, we look to the future and to more radical ideas of how we might yet balance the need for more homes, more new buildings, with well-made, intelligently planned, thoughtfully designed and heart-lifting towns and cities.
The Politics of Architecture was presented by Jonathan Glancy. The reader was Sean Murray, and the programme was produced by Phil Tinline.